Feminist women.
Mulheres feministas.
Zanone feminis.
Banyu vachikonzero chevakadzi.
Nessa.
Mulheres feministas.
Yam femini. Fem activis.
Nari mukti.
Matapang na babae. Kechi mai. Ka ishk.
Welcome to the year-end edition of Women's Magazine. We are your co-hosts, Preeti Shekhar
and Mary Simon.
This is the holiday season when consumption is on a high. The media and the market tell you it is time to celebrate and reconnect with your family and loved ones. But the underbelly of this hyped-up cheer is also a lot of despair and darkness that is not allowed any visibility and that many people continue to face every day. Death of a loved one or dieting to conform to false ideals of thinness are two commonplace realities people in the United States face. On Christmas Eve today, we at Women's Magazine invite you to join us as we creatively explore the two grim issues of death and dieting.
When the holidays roll around, so do the admonitions about gaining weight.
It's holiday season. That means a lot of eating at holiday parties.
Mm-hmm. And with all the tempting foods to choose from, it is easy to get really fat. Registered dietitian Lori Meyer joins us today, and Lori has some suggestions on not getting really fat.
The mainstream media is full of advice that they call helpful, like taking your own healthy snacks to parties and warnings about the evils of eggnog. Less space was devoted to a recently released study which found that people considered by the medical establishment to be overweight live longer and have lower risk of most diseases than people said to be at a, quote, healthy weight. But popular beliefs about what people should weigh and whether these ideal body sizes are achievable conflict with all scientific evidence, says Gina Collada, a science writer for the New York Times. From adolescence to youth and through old age, women face pressure all their lives to conform to an idealized thinness that advertisers sell as achievable through dieting. Studies find that 4 out of 5 American women are dissatisfied with the way they look, and on any given day, 1 out of 2 women is on a diet. Kate Raphael spoke with Gina about her latest book, Rethinking Thin, The Myths and Realities of Weight Loss and Dieting.
Here at KPFA 94.1, this is Women's Magazine. I'm Kate Raphael. If you're like 90% of American women, you spend a lot of your time thinking about your weight. On any given day, 45% of U.S. women are on a diet. Of college-aged women, only 9% have never tried to lose weight. There are at least 2,500 diet books currently on the market. Most of what we read or hear in the media about scientific and medical research tells us that despite the prevalence of dieting, we should be obsessing about our weight even more. A report issued by Johns Hopkins University researchers this past July reports that 66% of Americans are currently overweight, and by the year 2015, they say 75% will be overweight and 40% will be obese. What is causing this apparent crisis? Simple, we're told. We're eating too large portions of all the wrong foods and not getting enough exercise. Gina Collada, science writer for the New York Times, has a different perspective. In her book, Rethinking Thin, which came out a few months ago, Gina explodes some of our most deeply held beliefs about weight and dieting. Gina, welcome to Women's Magazine.
Thank you, Kate. It's wonderful to talk to you today.
So your new book is Rethinking Thin, The New Science of Weight Loss and the Myths and Realities of Dieting. Can you start by summarizing for us some of those myths and realities about dieting?
I think the biggest myth is this idea that anybody who really wanted to could be almost arbitrarily thin. We have these weights that are called healthy weights or goal weights or normal weights, and the idea is if you really cared, you too, no matter how fat you are, could be at that perfect weight. And I think that that's dominated people's thinking and the moralizing about people's weights, and it's just the science does not support it.
Why did you decide to write this book at this time?
For years and years, I've been following this story of the developing science, as researchers are finally understanding why it's so hard for people to control their weight and what really is going on in their brain. How much free will do you really have about how much you're eating and what your weight is going to be? I wrote articles about it. A lot of them were on page one. They would sort of get a little blast of attention for a while. But then almost as soon as this research was done, each step along the way, it would be ignored, and the same myth would persist in the popular culture about dieting and weight loss. It was kind of interesting, this huge disconnect and this growing gap between what science knew and what the popular culture, what was popularly said about dieting. But when I write a book, I always like a story. I mean, my favorite thing to do is to read fiction, not nonfiction, so I want to read a story. I didn't just want to write a book that just talked about one research study after another. I kind of needed something to tie it together. And then I found out that the federal government was going to be starting a study comparing the Atkins diet to standard low-calorie diet. And it was going to be a 2-year study, which is really unusual in weight loss. And I learned that I could follow some of these people in the study and talk to them about what it was like, and I could see what happened. So that gave me a story. I sort of ended up with alternate chapters sort of talking about the history and science of the people's attempts to control their weights. And in alternate chapters, I would have like these real people who were out there going out in on Monday nights. It was almost like a Weight Watcher group, you know, talking about their struggles and their behavioral control measures and their diets and their exercise programs and their food diaries. And so that's sort of what made the book work for me.
When I first saw the excerpt of this book in the New York Times, I was really excited because it was reporting things that I had known for a long time, such as that more than 90% of diets fail over 5 years and that many people who lose weight end up gaining more weight than they had lost. But one of the things you cover that I didn't know much about was some of the history. And you talk about that a lot of the kind of fad diets that people are being sold now actually date back to the 19th century. Can you talk some about that history?
It was fascinating to me. I discovered that almost everything anybody says about dieting dates back to at least the 19th century, sometimes even earlier. But actually, in the 19th century, there were two best-selling books, and one of them was a huge international bestseller that were basically the Atkins diet. In fact, the second one, which was written by an undertaker named William Banting, became so popular that the word for dieting became banting. I mean, I even found an article in the New York Times talking about, it was laughing, sort of laughing at a fat reporter, a fat German reporter, who broke a chair when he sat on it at some sort of a press conference. And in the Times, the article said, this guy needs to do some banting. And then it went out of favor, and calorie counting came in. And that was when calorie counting, I mean, it was proposed as a scientific way to control your weight. And it's all just a matter of figuring calories in versus calories out. And people were saying calories are getting to be such a bore, they shouldn't be mentioned at every dinner table conversation. Restaurants were posting calorie counts on their menus. This was like the early 1900s. Even during the Depression, when people were in bread lines, there they were with calorie counts on menus, and they were saying 3/4 of all Americans are seriously overweight. I mean, it sounded like today. Around the same time, kind of I called them the enabling technologies came in. If you want to know how fat you are and really worry about your weight, you need several things. You need a bathroom scale. It used to be, until the early 1900s, that if you wanted to weigh yourself, you had to go out to like one of those big hanging scales they used to weigh grain and things. And people actually used to do that. But you kind of wasn't easy to find out what your weight was. But then these platform scales came in. And first they were available in drugstores, and they would ring these loud bells when you stepped on them. And then manufacturers realized that really what would sell was something where you could go in the privacy of your home and weigh yourself. So suddenly bathroom scales came in. People could weigh themselves. Then you want to know, what do you look like? It used to be that mirrors were really, really expensive. And people maybe might have a hand mirror, but nobody had a full-length mirror. Then, and once again, around the beginning of the 20th century, mirrors became cheaper. And suddenly people had full-length mirrors, and they could see themselves. And the final thing you'd really want to do is you'd like to see a photograph of what the perfect person might look like. And that was also a time when photography became, the technology became available so you could start publishing pictures, not just drawings of people, in magazines and newspapers. So now you had the perfect bodies, you know, in newspapers and magazines. You had the scale, and you had the mirror. So everything was set up for people to really start obsessing about their weights. And that was the beginning of the time of, you know, all the one diet after another.
And yet you say that the first kind of very thin image that women were given to aspire to wasn't a photograph at all, but was an artist's rendition.
It was really funny. I had always thought the Gibson girl was actually a person. It was actually a drawing, an artist who drew what he thought was the perfect woman. And she was, in those days, considered thin. Now, today, we have very different standards. We probably think she could even lose weight. It's really, really weird. You look back at people who are considered thin, like flappers, and you say, they don't look thin to our eyes. But he drew this young woman, and she was, people thought that she was so alluring that women would put her pictures in the magazines on their walls, and people would try to dress like her. They would try to be her, just like a Barbie doll. You know, people have some idea of what this perfect person would look like. It's something most people would never achieve. That became the ideal.
So let's talk a little bit about the relationship between diet and health and weight and health.
You know, it's really interesting because as we've gotten fatter as a nation, and people have gotten fatter, and no one knows why, by the way, people have also gotten much healthier. Heart disease rates have just plummeted. Deaths from heart disease, deaths from everything have plummeted. People are living longer and longer and longer. Even disability rates are down. Everything is down. And I think the best data are some national data where they actually had representative samples of Americans where they had not just their reported weights, but their actual weights. They weighed them and measured them. And it looks like if you ask what's the best weight range to be in to live a long life, it's the range that people consider overweight. The worst weights are the very thin and the very, very heavy. But the so-called overweight range, and most people in that range think that they're too fat, that's the weight that seems to be maybe the best for living a long life.
A lot of people that I've told about your book have responded, well, but I know a lot of people who had diabetes and they had high blood pressure, they had high cholesterol, and when they lost weight, all those problems cleared up. So are you saying that fat people are not at increased risk for those conditions?
Well, the one thing that they are for sure at increased risk of, but it's not as much of a risk as people have often said, is diabetes. But the risk doesn't really kick in until you get to the obesity range. And a lot of it is genetics, and most people who are overweight or obese do not have diabetes, interestingly enough. But it turns out that with a lot of these things, with diabetes, for example, the moment that you don't eat as much, I mean, like if you starve yourself for a day, your blood sugar gets better. They say that when people have had this bariatric surgery, which is a weight loss surgery, the moment they have it, before they've lost 1 pound, their diabetes is better. The fact of not having as many calories as you need, sort of being in caloric imbalance, improves your blood sugar instantly overnight. So what you'd really like to know is, over the long term, are you better off or not? And what diabetes researchers told me is that people have who are prone to diabetes and people who are going to get it, they have what one guy called a tipping point. And it can be different for each person. One person's tipping point might be like 235 pounds. And if they weigh more than that, their blood sugar starts getting out of control, unless they're fine. They may still be fat at 220 pounds, but they don't have a diabetes problem. Not everybody who's fat is unhealthy. And not everybody who's fat, in fact, most people who are fat cannot lose substantial amounts of weight. I mean, I think most people listening to me, or I know for myself, if I try to lose even 10 pounds, certainly 20 pounds, there is no way. There's no way. I would be starving all the time and it would come back. That's my main message. You can't expect people to become arbitrarily thin just through saying, I think I'll eat a little bit less.
I think one of the assumptions that we make and that we're led to make is that people who are fat are eating less healthfully than people who are thin. And sort of the related assumption is that people who are thin are necessarily healthy just because they're thin.
You know, it's interesting. And when I was following the dieters in my book, they definitely changed the way they looked at food, thought about food. And one woman, Graciela Mann, in the book, she really tried very hard. She was in the low-calorie group. She totally changed the way she ate. I mean, she switched to all healthy foods. She, of course, she counts calories. She got a personal trainer. She goes to the gym all the time. At the end of the study, despite her enormous efforts, she was still fat. And she said, I feel better now. I work out now. I ran for the bus the other day, and I was fine. I would have just been dying. I would have been so winded in the past. But she said, I have to just face the fact that I will never be a thin person. She said she used to eat donuts and stuff in the morning. Now she doesn't have that. She's changed her diet completely, but she's still fat.
And a quote from the book is, maybe the obese eat differently, but no, that turned out not to be true.
Even people say, well, they eat too fast. Well, they don't. Fat people eat fast. Some fat people eat slowly. Same thing with thin people. Some eat fast, some eat slowly. There's no eating behavior that defines fat people. There's no psychological problem that defines fat people. Some fat people are depressed, so are some thin people. So when people say, oh, the reason I'm fat is that I'm under stress, you say, well, you know what? There's thin people who are also under stress. And if you put two people behind a screen, a fat person and a thin person, and to ask them some questions about their lives and their stress or their psychology, you couldn't tell me which one was fat and which one was thin. So it's a kind of like an after-the-fact explanation or blaming of the person for their weight, when actually what the science has been finding is that you can go up and down maybe 10 or 20 pounds, but if you try to go outside of a comfortable range for your body, your body fights back. If you go down too low, your metabolism slows down a whole lot. So the same amount of food that was keeping your weight steady now is making you gain.
One of the things that you hear, I think I hear it every day on the radio, is part of the reason that we're fatter than we used to be is that we're getting less exercise and people are watching too much TV and kids are playing too many video games. One of the quotes from your book that really surprised me was, national data did not indicate that Americans are any less active than they used to be.
It's very hard to know how active people are, but there's nothing that would tell you that they're less active than they were before. Actually, you think about it, when do people start gaining weight? Well, like in the 80s or so. Well, that's when health clubs really came in. And every place I look, I see in my neighborhood, people are all walking all the time. And in the 1960s, I wrote a previous book called Ultimate Fitness, and it was on exercise. And I went into the history of exercise then. And people actually didn't think they should exercise and purposely didn't do it. That's when these exercise evangelists came around, like Kenneth Cooper. And this is a time when people were thin, actually, compared to now, a lot thinner. And he would go around and try to tell people they should exercise. And he said men would say to him, I don't have to exercise. I sit at a desk all day. What do I need endurance for?
So you mention in the book that doctors frequently tell fat people that all their health problems are due to their weight and the only solution is for them to diet.
People who are obese say it's very difficult even to find a doctor, because as soon as you walk in, the doctor assumes that your problem is that you're fat. And there have been a lot of studies showing that many doctors really discriminate against fat people. They won't operate on them. They won't offer them tests that they offer thinner people. They blame every health problem on the person's weight.
And what about the relationship between social class and weight?
It looks like the lower the socioeconomic status, the fatter people tend to be. And it's been a mystery, and it's been persistent, and some people think it's one reason that there's so much discrimination against fat people, because it's actually a way of discriminating also against poorer people. A woman who's fat is less likely to marry, and when she does marry, she tends to marry a man who is of lower social class. So you can start dropping down in your income and in your social class when you're fat. Women who are, and this has been shown particularly in women who are fat are less likely to go to college.
I know, too, that there are disparities among racial groups, and that African Americans and Latinos and Native Americans in general have a much higher rate of what's called obesity. And one of the reasons that we commonly hear why this is true is that there's an absence of fresh fruits and vegetables aren't available or they cost too much in neighborhoods that are primarily people of color. You talk a little bit about that in your book.
There was one study that was totally ignored. It was ignored, I think, because the answers weren't what people wanted to hear. It was a huge, expensive study done by the federal government, and it was done mostly in the Southwest, and where there was a lot of Native Americans who had a real severe obesity problem. And with the hope was that you could intervene and prevent kids from getting fat by changing what they ate and giving them more exercise. So the researchers randomized schools to being intervention schools or control schools. And the intervention schools, they got rid of all junk food. They taught the kids how to eat. They brought the parents in. They taught the parents about how to make lunches and what to eat. They brought in special PE teachers, and they had extra PE breaks, and the kids were taught everything about exercise. Kids were in these intervention programs for like 2 years. At the end of the program, the kids knew their lessons well. They knew everything about nutritious, non-nutritious food. They knew all about exercise, but they were no thinner than the kids in the non-intervention schools. I think that the message is that there's more to this than just trying to change the environment. In fact, there is another study that I talk about in my book with adoptees. Here, this was a study where they asked, if you have kids who were adopted and never knew their biological parents, when they're adults, who will they resemble more, their biological parents or their adoptive parents? And this study was done in Denmark where they had really good adoption records. And the answer was that their body weights were like those of their biological parents who they had never even known.
This information, as you mentioned, is kind of consistently ignored, if not covered up. What do money and corporate power have to do with it?
Well, of course, everybody knows that there's kind of a whole industry, a whole obesity industry. The research money is all there to try to continue doing study after study, saying people are fat, people are fat, people are fat.
I want to turn to the role of the media in promoting what are basically false ideas about how thin people can be and how thin we should be. And you document some instances where the media colluded with scientists essentially to cover up study results that didn't support the obsession with obesity as a health crisis. A couple weeks ago, there was a study that you reported on that found that in general, overweight people had a lower risk of dying from most diseases than people considered to be at a healthy weight. And one of the things I noticed, you wrote an article in the New York Times, and the headline it was published under was, "Causes of death are linked to a person's weight." Which, of course, is true.
Yeah.
It is linked to a person's weight. If you're a lower weight, you're more likely to die of most things. But the impression that it created was exactly the opposite of what the article actually said.
You know, it's so funny, now that you mention it, you're absolutely right, but I never pay attention to the headlines because I don't write them.
That kind of leads me into a question which is a little difficult to ask, but it concerns some other issues that you've reported on, such as the health risks of silicone breast implants and whether certain chemicals are risks for cancer. A reporter named Mark Dowie, writing in The Nation, charged that upon re-interviewing the people that you cite, it becomes evident that you appear to have decided before making your first call what your story will say. Those scientists who disagree with you are either ignored, dismissed, or trumped by someone anointed with higher authority. And this, Dowie argues, reflects a Times policy toward coverage that is anti-environment and pro-corporate. Can you respond to that a little?
Well, I would like to say that my reporting pretty much speaks for itself. And from Mark Dowie's article, it was pretty funny. I mean, one of the people he accused me of not calling happened to be dead. So it was an article where the guy kind of had a chip on his shoulder. And it was like, let's go after the New York Times reporter on silicone breast implants. I think when every group, including the National Academy of Sciences, people had nothing to do. They brought all sorts of expert panels, people who'd never had any vested interest in it, looked at the science and said it doesn't support long-term systemic effects like lupus and scleroderma. I would be remiss if I didn't report it.
Just in closing, are you willing to tell us what your diet's like?
I'm very thin, and I actually eat what I want. If I had had a weight problem, then I think that people would think my book would be special pleading. They wouldn't believe me. They'd say she's writing that book to excuse herself.
I've been speaking with Gina Kalata, science writer for the New York Times and author of the new book, Rethinking Thin. Gina, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us today.
That was Kate Raphael talking to New York Times science writer Gina Kalata. In addition to Rethinking Thin, Gina Kalata is the author of 5 previous books, including Sex in America, The Baby Doctors, Probing the Limits of Fetal Medicine, and Clone, The Road to Dolly and the Path Ahead. More information about the fat acceptance movement, including lists of fat-friendly doctors, is available from the website of the National Association to Advance Fat Acceptance, www.naafa.org, and www.fatso.com. Chocolate cake, why'd you do me wrong? You go to my hip, where you never belong. Why can't I eat what I like? When will those calories go on strike? I've got the
was Diet Blues by Iris Ann Hirsch.
Because I could not stop for death, he kindly stopped for me. The carriage held but just ourselves and immortality. Those are the opening lines of the poem Time and Eternity by popular American poet Emily Dickinson, who wrote extensively on death. In general, American society is quite silent on the subject of death. Filmmaker Dr. Michelle Petacola found that she was unprepared for the death of her parents. That experience led Petacola to begin a quest to understand death that led to her four-part documentary series, Secrets of Life and Death.
This is Mary Simon for Women's Magazine on KPFA at 94.1 FM. We are a nation obsessed with youth. The topic of death exposes the fragility of life, and even talking about it makes us uncomfortable. But avoiding the subject can make it harder when death touches our lives. Today's guest, Dr. Michelle Petacola, calls death an opportunity of profound importance, a chance to rediscover our essence, the nature of our being. For the last 8 years, Michelle has been working on a four-part documentary called The Secrets of Life and Death. The film tells her story and that of others in an effort to help understand and prepare for the end-of-life experience. Since 1984, Michelle has been studying with a Sufi master from Baghdad and for 10 years served as his media director. She currently teaches seminars on death at John F. Kennedy University and leads a partner loss support group for a local hospice. Thank you for joining me, Michelle.
Thank you.
Michelle, this is obviously a very personal project. Can you explain what made you want to tackle such a difficult subject?
Well, I had been working in video, and I had the feeling that I wanted to do a documentary, but I didn't know what I wanted to do because when you do a documentary, it takes a long time. And then my parents died. They died within 6 months of each other, and I was so stunned, so amazed by the intensity of the experience that I thought, this is the topic. And not only because it was intense, but because I really felt unprepared. I felt like my culture, my society had let me down, that there was this incredible, important event that we all go through that we don't have any preparation for. I wanted to help other people so they didn't have to go through what I had gone through, which was, well, I made mistakes. I made choices that were based on ignorance. So that was the main reason.
Are there things specific to the American culture that makes us reluctant to talk about death?
The consumer society is really not compatible with death. I think death makes us treat life in a different way, as not about acquisition, because A, you can't take any of that stuff with you, and B, it makes you think about the finite amount of time you have and what you're here for, or what maybe your purpose is. And that's very different from what our culture really emphasizes, which is buy things and accumulate things and accomplish things that have to do with, oh, I'm an important person, look at what I did. Death really puts you back into what's really important, and what's really important is relationships. And you don't need to buy things to have relationships.
Were there certain cultures you looked to during your work that handled this topic better?
I was trying to look in our culture for people that were handling it to get guidance from. What I found was that Buddhism is a really good culture that has a very strong presence in our culture now for handling death. And a lot of the people that I interviewed ended up either being, well, having a background in Buddhism or actually being Buddhist. So I feel like they do have a very good culture for handling death or a good take on it.
So how do you think we can change?
I think by talking about it, I think it's a step in the right direction and becoming more comfortable with expressing what we're feeling. The other part of it is learning how to be present. I guess that's also the Buddhist culture, is learning how to be present, how to show up and be in the moment. And I think our culture, we tend to think about the future or fears about the past. And so we spend a lot of time in the future of the past, but death puts us in the present.
Do men and women deal with death differently?
I don't have a large sample to go by, but I have some feelings for it. Certainly women, because of our culture, are more comfortable in the helping position, that is, caregiving and helping people. Women are also more open, on the whole, to discussions about death. You know, in hospice support groups, women are much more represented there than men are. They're more used to or allowed in our culture to be aware of and express their feelings, whereas in our culture, men are not expected to or not encouraged to get in touch with their feelings. And that puts them at a disadvantage in dealing with death. On the other hand, when it comes to dying, the people that I found who were willing to talk about their experience were men. And it was interesting because somehow they were able to see their choice of being interviewed as an act of courage and an act of helping other people and sharing that. And I found women reticent to do that, to expose that. My sense was that they were never ready. I don't know that for them dying, that they could see that as a heroic act, dying. Caregiving is a heroic act for women, but maybe for men they can see death as a heroic act, as a heroic event.
You talk about the gifts of death. What do you mean by that?
There are a lot of gifts. I think one of the gifts is in learning more about ourselves. Whether that's you yourself who's dying, and so really learning what's important in your life, or accompanying somebody who's dying, and again, learning what's important in life. Any way in which you relate to death, if you really open to that experience, there are surprises there. There are lessons that can be learned from doing that, because death is this incredible event that's part of who we are. It's that step into the next phase, whatever that is. And it's essential to who we are.
What was one of those lessons either that you learned or that one of the people in your film?
Oh, I learned so many lessons.
Will you share one?
Yeah. For some reason, the one that's coming up for me right now is the lesson about forgiveness and acceptance. When I was dealing with my parents dying, I felt I made a lot of mistakes. When my father died, I did not go back to see the body, for example. My mother had called me the morning that she thought he was going to die, and I don't know, I just got the feeling that that wasn't going to happen that day. You know how it is, maybe you don't, with death, where each day you think this is going to be it, this is going to be it, and then finally you kind of get tired of waiting. I mean, it can go a long time, and so I didn't go back. So I didn't see him that last time. And then I didn't afterwards, when they called me and said that he had died, I didn't take the long 2-hour drive to go back because I didn't think it was important. So I had regrets about that. And then the same with my mother. I had seen her maybe 3 weeks before she died. But then when she actually went into coma, I didn't jump on a plane and go back. I thought, well, you know, it'll probably be okay, or I've seen her. And yet from my experience of talking to different people, I think it's important to see the dead body, to really get that that person is not in their body anymore. I think it's part of, helps the grieving process and the letting go. So I had these attitudes about myself or feelings about myself of having kind of messed up. That's where the forgiveness comes in. In the second film on caregiving, people talk about the things that they did. And I thought they did a great job of their caregiving. And yet all of them experienced at some point regret. And one of the people said, you know, it really doesn't matter what you do when somebody's dying. It's really their experience of dying. And you can't mess it up. You're not that powerful. You really can't do anything wrong. And that was really powerful for me. It was like, oh, I didn't mess up their death. I mean, yeah, there's some things that maybe in the future I might do differently. But I didn't mess up their death. They had the death that was right for them. So that was a powerful lesson. And I think a lot of people, because I work in a hospice support group, that's an issue for people after that somebody dies is, oh, I should have done this, I should have done that.
It seems the process of making these films helped you let yourself off the hook.
Oh, yes. Yes, the process of doing the film was a process of healing my grief. I think we all have these ideas about how a good death is supposed to be. And that was the other lesson I gained from doing this film, and that is that everybody has to have their own death. And so maybe you have all these ideas about holistic health and healing processes and, I don't know, reading Tibetan Book of the Dead or all that. you can't impose your ideas about what death should be on somebody who's dying. You have to really be there for them. You have to accept and support what they need.
This is KPFA's Women's Magazine. I'm talking with Dr. Michelle Petacola, producer-director of the documentary Secrets of Life and Death. How did your experience of being a caregiver change your perspective?
I think there are two things that you have to keep in mind when you're a caregiver. One is being present for the person who's dying. It is really hearing what they're saying and allowing them the space to say what they feel, encouraging them. The other part is being present for yourself and being aware of when it is time for you to take a break, realizing when it's too much, and being kind to yourself and giving yourself what you need.
My 14-year-old dog has cancer, and I'll find myself crying, and through the tears, there's this overwhelming joy. It's hard to explain, but it's this joy for having this time to be with her, but also this sadness that I'm going to be losing her.
I experienced something similar when my mother died. The euphoric aspect. I don't know whether there's something intoxicating in tears itself that do that. But part of it for me was realizing that this moment, this here and now, was more important, that took precedence over anything else. Nothing else was as important as the loss of my mother. There's something special about that. And then the other aspect is life in that time of grieving, in that time of somebody dying, is very precious. And it's also very magical. And so I think it's very unlike everyday life and special in that way. I think that also blends with or adds to the euphoric aspect of it. It's a very special time. I talked to this one woman who is what you call a death midwife, and she says that probably most times very magical things happen around the death event. And not to worry too much about how to deal with things, because people will magically show up. Times will magically synchronize. And so I think that's what's special also about death, is it's so unlike everyday life. It's what life really should be about. It's almost like a meditation. It's so real. It's so present. It's so in touch with the most important thing about what it is to be a human being and what it is to be alive. It's not caught up with the trivial.
What do you hope the film can add to the dialogue about death?
Well, actually, I'm hoping it will encourage the dialogue. I don't think that in any way my films do more than scratch the surface. Yet I think they also encourage people to talk. The reason I had put myself in the film was that I wanted to give the difficult side, the person who was not dealing with it so well, to encourage other people to talk about that, the problems they've had, instead of just having these people who do a good job, and then we say, oh, yeah, well, that was good for them, but what about me? So I wanted to show both sides of that. And I think that does help people to talk about their experience.
For those of us who have aging parents, for example, are there discussions you feel that we should be having with them, or ways that we can prepare together?
Oh, definitely. Sometimes it's hard to bring up the topic because it's not something that we bring up. So something like, oh, I saw this movie and it got me thinking. And what do you think? How do you want to have your death? Or what do you want after you die? And so you ask questions like, how do you want us to deal with your body? Do you want to be cremated? Do you want to be buried? What are your plans on that? Have you made plans? Durable power of attorney. That is, who is going to take care of your medical issues if, say, you become unable to answer or make those decisions yourself? Do you have a will? You want to make sure that your parents have taken care of, and probably they have. At least I found that the older generation is pretty good about that. But actually, discussing those things is something that they're not used to. So you make sure that the basic things are taken care of, and then maybe move into other things about, well, What do you think happens after you die? What are your beliefs about that? That's a good question. And maybe you've shared certain things of the same religious upbringing, so you have some ideas about maybe what they've been exposed to, but what do they really believe? Have they really thought about that?
Yeah, I recently started having some dialogue with my mother, and she told me she didn't want to donate her organs, and it's just something I didn't know. I was surprised.
That whole organ donor question is a tricky one, because if you do donate your organs, the medical personnel have to come running in and grabbing the body out and removing the organs pretty quickly in order for them to maintain their integrity. And yet, I believe that there's something sacred about that moment of death and that space afterwards. And I think it would be pretty unnerving for the people who care about you, if you're the one who's dying, or yourself, if you were there with your parents, to have to suddenly vacate the premises because they're running in and grabbing your loved one to harvest organs. You can see I have some mixed feelings. On the one hand, I think it's really great if we enable people who need our organs to have a second chance. But on the other hand, we have to balance what feels right for us.
I hadn't thought about the other side. What are your hopes for your end of life?
Well, I guess I would like to not have to linger a long time. I would also like to have enough time to complete all my relationships. And so I don't know that I would want to have that sudden death, because I think that's very hard. I mean, it's great for the person who dies because, you know, you don't have to suffer or at least not for very long. But for the people who are left behind, that's very, very difficult. It's one of the hardest things to adjust to. So it would be nice to have some time. I would like to be conscious. I'd like to have my faculties so that I can dialogue and share my experiences with people, with my loved ones, with the people I care about.
And that was something you weren't able to have with your mother?
Well, in a way, yes. It's just that I had expectations, see, about how I would like to have the dialogue. Actually, I had the dialogue that we needed, which was, well, what are your favorite memories? What a perfect thing to ask is, talk about your life. What was good in your life? And that's what she talked about. And that's one of the things that I guess people who have studied the process of dying really encourage is what they call the life review, is giving people the opportunity to reflect on what their life was about and what they remember is the good times.
Holidays are an especially difficult time to deal with loss. Any recommendations?
Well, don't ignore it. That is, be proactive. Think about how you're going to spend the holiday. Don't let it just fall on you. Some people find that it's helpful to go away, especially if it's within the first year of having lost somebody in your home, is to go away, to do something different. Because if you do the same thing, then the loss of that person might be more than you can handle. Or if you are going to do the same things, bring the dead one to the event. That is, don't treat that lost person like the ignored big elephant in the living room, but invite them in. Maybe set a place setting for them at the table. Talk about how they would have handled that event or remember stories about that person.
Wonderful suggestion. So, Michelle, at this point you have finished parts 1 and 2, which are facing death and caring for the dying, and parts 3 and 4, which are grieving the dead and making life out of death, will be available in 2008?
I hope so.
You've obviously put a lot of yourself into this project. Thank you, Michelle. It was great to talk to you.
Thank you, Mary. I really appreciated it. I really enjoyed it.
I'm Mary Simon with Women's Magazine here at KPFA. I've been talking with producer-director Dr. Michelle Petacola about her documentary series, Secrets of Life and Death.
I can't predict the future. All I have really is right now. That's all I have is this very moment. I don't even have moments 3 hours from now. You know, it's like stealing from time. This is it. This is as good as it gets right here, right now. We must be willing to let go of the life we have planned so as to have the life that is waiting for us. And that's, you know, really what it's about.
That was a clip from part one, Facing Death. You can see part two, Caring for the Dying, The Art of Being Present, on March 3, 2008, from 7 to 9 p.m., at the Kensington Library at 61 Arlington Avenue. For more information about the four-part documentary, The Secrets of Life and Death, visit secretsoflifeanddeath.com. On the site, you can find Michelle's email address and sign up to get notified about future screenings.
That was Remember When by Elise Lebeque. The piece opened with Possible Dream, also by Lebeque. Her music is featured in the film Secrets of Life and Death.
Before we wrap up, we would like to share an important news update about the New Orleans chapter of Insight, Women of Color Against Violence, a national activist organization of radical feminists of color. The New Orleans City Council recently approved the demolition of 4,500 units of public housing by HUD. Activists and community members protesting the decision were brutally assaulted, pepper sprayed, and tasered by police during the hearing. Public housing residents are predominantly women and children of color. Denying safe housing is an act of violence and increases vulnerability to domestic and sexual violence and poverty. Gentrification and forced displacement is happening to women of color in communities across the United States and abroad. In this regard, we join the New Orleans chapter of Insight in its appeal for the Women's Health Clinic. The New Orleans Women's Health Clinic, a women of color-led project, has become a critical resource with vast potential for comprehensive health education and grassroots organizing activities. The New Orleans Women's Health Clinic equips marginalized and underserved women with the means to control and care for their own bodies, sexuality, and reproduction through a holistic, community-centered, well-woman approach to healthcare, which integrates sexual health and reproductive justice. The clinic was conceived to combine health services with a political analysis of the oppression that prevents low-income, uninsured, immigrant, disabled, or differently abled, formerly incarcerated, and LGBTQ women of color from receiving comprehensive health care. The Women's Health Clinic not only provides health care services, but also addresses the social invisibility of low-income women of color that allows their needs to be chronically ignored and unmet. Since the New Orleans Women's Health Clinic opened in May, the demand for its services has steadily increased. The clinic needs your help to continue doing its work. You can make contributions to Insight online at www.insight-national.org/support or mail your checks to New Orleans Women's Health Clinic, 1406 Esplanade Avenue, New Orleans, Louisiana, 70116.
Up next is the Women's Calendar.
This is a listing of upcoming events for by women in the Bay Area for the week of December 17th through December 30th. Please listen closely for contact numbers. Women Breaking Barriers, Women's Music from 1964 to 1984. Come to the closing reception honoring the Women's Music Movement exhibit. Share your special story of the importance of women's music on Thursday, December 27th at 6 p.m. at the GLBT Historical Society, 657 Mission Street, number 300 in San Francisco. For info, call 415-777-5455 or visit glbthistory.org. Divas of the Divine. Composer Mary Watkins moves fluidly and masterfully within and between the classical and jazz traditions, incorporating other styles of music into her original works. Barbara Borden is a leader in drumming circles and peace and reconciliation projects. Wild Sang delivers songs chock full of the sweat, deep love, and sacrifice you can squeeze out of the blues. Lisa Cohn is a truly gifted and unique Bay Area blues, jazz, and gospel vocalist. She will be performing with Jan Martinelli on bass and Robin Lewis on guitar, hosted by poet and author Linda Zeiser, on Friday, December 28th at 7 p.m. at the Home of Truth Sanctuary, 1300 Grand Avenue in Alameda. For info, call 510-276-0379. All events are wheelchair accessible. The calendar is produced by members of the KPFA Women's Magazine. If you have an upcoming event, please send it to yvette618@gmail.com or mail it to Women's Magazine at KPFA 1929 Martin Luther King Jr. Way, Berkeley, California 94704. You can find much more in the calendar on our website at kpfa.org/womensmagazine. Please make sure that your event is wheelchair accessible.
If you missed any of our 2007 shows, you can find them in our archives online at kpfa.org/womensmagazine. We encourage you to listen and send us feedback at womensmagazine@comcast.net. We'd like to thank Kate Raphael and Yvette Hopberg for their help with today's show. We look forward to having you join us next year. Until 2008, this is Mary Simon with Preeti Shaker.
Kick it, the rhyme it is wicked. Those that don't know how to be pros get evicted. A woman could bear you, break you, take you. Now it's time to rhyme. Can you relate to a sister's open up to make you holler and scream?
Yo, let me take it from here, queen. Excuse me, but I think I'm about due to get into precisely what I am about to do. I'm conversating to the folks who have no whatsoever clue. So listen very carefully as I break it down for you. Merrily, 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 high to happy overjoyed. Please, with all the beats and rhymes my sisters have employed. Look, as you're going down the sound, totally a yes. Let me state the position. Ladies first, yes?
Yes.
Yeah, there's gonna be some changes right there.
Being a woman is great to see. I know that all the fellas out there will agree with me. Not for being one, but for being with one. Cause when it's time for loving, it's the woman that gets them drawn. Stepping, strutting, moving on. Rhyming, cutting, and not forgetting. We are the ones to give birth to the new generation of prophets. Cause it's late.
I break into a lyrical freestyle. Grab the mic, look at the crowd and see smiles. Cause they see a woman standing up on her own too. Sloppy slouching is something I won't do. Something that we can't flow.
Can't flow.
Stereotypes, they got to go.
Got to go.
I'ma mess around and flip the scene into reverse.
With what?
With a little touch of ladies first. My mind expands throughout the universe. A female rapper with a message to send. The Queen Latifah is a perfect specimen.
My sister, can I get some?
Sure, Moni Love, grab the mic and get dumb.
Yo, praise me not for being simply what I am. Born in L-O-N-D-O and sound American. You dig exactly where I'm coming from. You want righteous rhyming, I'ma give you some. To enable you to age yourself and get paid. And the material that has no meaning, I wish to play. Pay me every bit of your attention. Like mother, like daughter, I would also like to mention. I wish for you to bring me to the bring me to the rhythm. Of which is now systematically given. Desperately stressing, I'm the daughter of a sister. Who's the mother of a brother, who's the brother of another. Plus one more, or four, have
have a job to do. We doing it. Respect due to the mother who's the root of it. And next up is me, the M-O-N-I-E-L-O-V-E. And I'm first, cause I'm a L-A-Z-I-E.
Contact and in fact, the style it gets harder. Cooling on the scene with my European partner. Laying down track after track, waiting for the climax. When I get there, that's when I attack the next man or the next woman. This doesn't make a difference. Keep the competition coming. And I recite chapter and verse. The title of this recital is Ladies First.